May it please the court. It's my pleasure to represent Mr. Daniel Ajak on appeal of his misdemeanor conviction for resisting arrest. It was the only conviction remaining after his jury found him not guilty of two underlying assaults and then hung on the third, which the state then dismissed. The not guilty verdicts were perhaps not surprising because at trial, two of the state's witnesses testified that another adult in the home was the aggressor in the confrontation with Mr. Ajak, and he was responding to her actions. Indeed, when the officers arrived, he was bleeding from the mouth. He approached them with his hands up, maintaining throughout that he was the victim. Nonetheless, they placed him in handcuffs and sat him in the kitchen. Mr. Ajak was confused and upset about why he was being handcuffed. He felt that since he was the only African-American person in the home that they were targeting him unfairly. Yet he offered no resistance and sat handcuffed.
Excuse me, how long was he handcuffed in the kitchen before being escorted to the police car?
I don't think the record is clear about that. Yeah. Although it was sufficient time for them to talk to all the other people in the home. The actual aggressor in the case had fled the home, so they talked to his girlfriend and her adult son at the least. There were several children in the home, but I don't think there's any indication that they were talked to. So I'm guessing several minutes at the very least. But he sat handcuffed in the kitchen without any resistance. And ultimately, officers came into the kitchen and told him he was under arrest. Both officers testified he was told he was under arrest. The question in this case is whether Mr. Ajak could have resisted an arrest that had already been fully effectuated in the kitchen. In other words, did Mr. Ajak's actions later, while being escorted to the patrol car, constitute resisting when the arrest had already been fully effectuated at an earlier point in time? Our position is that the statutes and the case law support that an arrest occurs at a fixed point in time, that it's not an ongoing event of unknown duration, that officers certainly know when an arrest occurs, and there are several reasons why the statutes are not ambiguous on this account. The legislature has clearly defined an arrest in Section 544.180, and it's presumed that the General Assembly legislates with the knowledge of the existing law. So when the legislature enacted Section 575.150, the resisting arrest statute, it was well aware that we had a definition of arrest since 1879. If the legislature had intended to broaden the definition of arrest into an ongoing event, it could easily have done so in the statute. The statute is not ambiguous. It's not ambiguous when you look at it in the context of the other statutes in that act, the escape from custody statute, Section 575.200, says that a suspect being held in custody after an arrest for any crime. Custody is defined in 556.061 as a person is in custody when the person has been arrested. That contemplates that the arrest has occurred at a point in time, and at that point, he is in custody. Now, we're not arguing that there may have been another crime that Mr. Ajak committed when he was being escorted out to the patrol car, but that is not what was charged. He was charged with resisting an arrest. And the resisting statute itself says
that...
Doesn't
it contemplate the definition of that, some type of structural barrier that prevents the person from escaping?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because a patrol car is not always used in an arrest. For instance, a lot of times arrest warrants are effectuated at a courthouse when people come to testify or are there on other charges, and they are taken into custody, placed under arrest pursuant to the warrant, and they are then in custody. They're not always immediately transported in a patrol car. Sometimes they're held in the jail. So I think custody occurs subsequent to the arrest being effectuated. And if at that time, and there are laws that prevent attempting to escape from that custody, actually escaping, assaulting a law enforcement officer while they have you in custody. And there's all sorts of crimes that protect police officers in that situation. But when we're talking specifically about the definition of arrest, the legislature has given us one, and it occurs when you are actually restrained or submit to the custody, submit to the control of the officer. At that point, we assert that you are then in custody.
Then the definition of custody is when the person has been arrested but has not yet been delivered to a place of confinement. So it seems to be enacted to fill in the gap between there's an arrest and you're confined, and what do you call the in-between time? And that you
certainly
call that custody.
That's
so it's
custody.
A broader
period. And it could encompass a delivery in a patrol car. If any of the protesters in St. Louis were arrested outside the jail, I'm sure they would be walked right into the jail. It doesn't involve a patrol car. They're not enclosed in any specific area until then. So, yes, there is a separate point in time from the time you're enclosed in a jail cell from when you are arrested, and that period of time is called custody. And there are certain things you can do in custody that will bring charges. But that's not the situation that Mr. Ajax was in.
Why is it to your client's benefit to make this argument, since the penalties and the degree of crime are the same or even higher for custody?
I don't know that there is a specific benefit or not to him directly.
You just
directly,
simply
but
think it's incorrect?
It's what the state charged. And we believe that by applying a different definition of arrest, like judicially creating a definition of arrest that would encompass that, is going to affect future cases, confuse police officers who are already well aware of what an arrest entails and when it occurs. Both officers here testified he was under arrest at that moment in the kitchen. And in my reply brief, I cited to Smither versus Director of Revenue, and I think it provides a very good roadmap for the court in applying Section 544-180 to the resisting arrest statute, because there, in Smither, it was a Director of Revenue case. The Director of Revenue had revoked Mr. Smither's license pursuant to the implied consent statute. The trial court had found that the director met two of the three prongs necessary. The officer had reasonable grounds to believe the driver was driving intoxicated, and the driver refused to submit to the test of his BAC. But the trial court found that he was not arrested because he was in a hospital bed. They couldn't put actual physical restraints or handcuffs on him while he was being cared for at the hospital. So he said at that point he was not under arrest. But this court stated that the term arrest is defined. In fact, it jumped right to Section 544-180. It didn't find that there was any ambiguity and that the definition of arrest in 544-180 directly applied to Director of Revenue cases. And it said the term arrest is defined as actual restraint of the person or defendant or submission to custody of the officer under authority of warrant or otherwise, citing Section 544-180. Merely informing someone who's under arrest is insufficient. Proof of physical restraint or submission is required to effectuate an arrest, and cited Hodari D. So at that point, this court held that the arrest had been effectuated when he was in the hospital bed. He was physically restrained in the bed and was told he was under arrest, and at that moment, the arrest had been effectuated. And I think that's exactly the analysis that needs imported to the resisting arrest statute. The same rules would apply. Mr. Ajax was handcuffed in his kitchen, so he was actually restrained. I would argue he was also at that time submitting to custody, but it's kind of irrelevant because he was handcuffed at the time, so both were there. And then when he was told, you're under arrest, then they were acting with the probable cause that they were going to arrest him, and at that moment his arrest was effectuated.
Would you clarify for me, is your argument that the definition of arrest in 544-180 we are compelled to use, or are you arguing that it is available to be used as a reasonable definition of arrest?
I believe you're compelled to use it because the statute is not ambiguous.
Well, my recollection is there are cases that talk about taking something from another chapter, considering it from another chapter, and I don't think they argue that it is that it's clear legislative intent that it is used, that definition is used in all sections of all chapters and all sections of the statute.
I think what I would say, Your Honor, is I'm not clear when, if it's only when statutes are ambiguous that statutory interpretation is applied, but there is a maxim that it's presumed that the General Assembly legislates with knowledge of existing laws. And so they're presumed to know that there's a longstanding definition of arrest.
But it's in a different chapter. That's my
correct
question. And
okay,
I thought there was case law that said you don't presume that they intend a definition of something in one chapter to govern everything in the entire statutes.
I think
it's permissible to use it, but is it mandatory?
Would this be affected by the fact this isn't like this is some unrelated chapter? The chapter it was taken from was Chapter 544, Arrest, Examination, Commitment, and Bail. It provides all the basic rules regarding what is bail, what is arrest, what are the rights to issue warrants and issue process. It's a definition chapter and a base chapter that provides the rules for applying the criminal laws and the succeeding chapters. It's part of the criminal procedure sections of the statute.
It is, and I think in I cited Balloons Over the Rainbow Incorporated in my brief. It's when the legislature enacts a statute referring to terms that have other judicial or legislative meanings attached to them, the legislature is presumed to have acted with knowledge of that legislative action. So I suppose that would assume that another legislative action is Section 544-180. And it would certainly be unreasonable, I believe, to think that the legislature did not intend for the criminal procedure definition of arrest to apply in criminal statutes. I see my time is up. Thank you.
Please, the court. Our position, Your Honors, is that the arrest began when the officers informed Daniel Ajak that he was under arrest, but it was not completed until he was placed into the patrol unit. I do believe that the arrest is an ongoing thing. The mere words that the officer says to an individual that you're being placed under arrest don't conclude the arrest. It continues until the individual is actually placed in custody.
And is there anything in the statute that supports that interpretation?
My argument comes from the 575-150, 575-200, and 575-210, each outlining the different resisting arrest, escape from custody, and escape from confinement. And when you read them together, it's clear that there is an ongoing process here where the arrest happens and then it leads into custody.
And I think everybody agrees with that. It's the point at which it does. And 544-180 says an arrest is made by an actual restraint of the person of the defendant or by his submission to the custody of the officer.
And I agree that statute is helpful for us, but I do not believe that.
And so does nothing in, you know, the criminal code, you're saying it can't control the criminal code. That's only chapters 556 to basically 580 up to 600 for a definition. All these prior chapters giving the courts authority to conduct searches and seizures, to arrest, to commit, to examine defendants, to set bail, to set, it gives authority to pursue people and so forth. If those don't govern the criminal code, then we have no authority to do any of those things. They must be intended to be read together.
They are, and I do believe that they are, but I believe that if the legislature intended this specific definition to rule over the 577
No, if there's a conflict, but where's the conflict?
I don't believe, if they intended this definition, they would have put a cross-reference
so
to it. Like
so again, if they intended bail to be allowed for people under the code, they would have put bail in there? It doesn't make sense to me that you're saying these set out the procedures that have to be followed in finding people guilty of the crime set out in the criminal code. Otherwise, there are none.
Well, I don't believe they intended to make a specific definition of arrest. There were the...
So just that provision's not incorporated? You see my problem. If you're saying the arrest definition doesn't apply in the code, then why does anything else apply in the code?
I believe that
I think
does
your argument doesn't follow because it would mean none of this applies.
It does apply, but it simply says when an arrest happens.
Yes.
And to me, an arrest is an ongoing process.
Is there anything in this definition that suggests that?
That
it's an ongoing process because it says when they're restrained or when you submit to the authority and you have to say they're under arrest.
I believe that's suggested by 575, the resisting arrest statute, the escape from custody and the escape from confinement, where they are overlapping or they have to lead into each other. Does that answer that question?
No,
okay.
but go ahead and explain further why you think it does. That would be great. Why? Tell me what about 575 you think in those particular definitions create some vagueness as to arrest that doesn't exist under the definition itself.
Well, I think those statutes setting out the crime, and then we also have a 556-061 that
yes.
defines custody and confinement.
And it says after arrest. It says custody occurs after arrest.
Yes.
But before confinement.
And so then we can look at 544-180 that gives us an idea of when the arrest happened. But I don't think it clearly sets out that that is completed at that point. It says that the actual restraint of the person or submission to the custody.
Right.
And to say actual restraint, I think there's some ambiguity there of what is restraining this person. In this case, the individual was taken to the kitchen, seated at the table, and detained there in handcuffs while they were talking to other individuals based on they thought they needed to for their safety at that point. It was several minutes. I don't think it was clear with the testimony exactly how long he was seated there, but during that time frame, he continued to attempt to stand up, attempt to lunge at the officers. I think that was clear on the record. He wasn't just sitting there submitting to their custody. He was yelling at them and trying to get up still. So eventually at that point they did, after they talked to everybody, they did tell him that you're being arrested at this point. They tried to get him some shoes so they could escort him out of the residence. But my belief is that until they got him out of the residence and confined him the location of the vehicle, that he wasn't secured, that they didn't securely have him. He continued to try to break away.
But you have to be in a vehicle to be in custody? Does custody only apply there?
I don't think it specifically has to be a vehicle.
So what does it have to be? If we were going to give definitions so people have guidance, how would we define it?
I think it has to be within certain physical limits, certain enclosed space of some type,
And where do you get that from the language of the statute, of the definition of custody?
That is from some of the case law that I have reviewed on, where it talks about custody goes beyond the arrest once the person is within certain physical limits.
Because do you find it within the plain and ordinary language of the definition of custody?
No. I believe that is where I got that is from the case law that kind of that talks about all of the definitions of custody and confinement. Again, when I'm talking about the arrest being ongoing, while he's being escorted out of the residence, he's still attempting to get away from them. And he could have been able to get away if the officers weren't strong enough or had a good enough grip. So he really isn't within their custody at that point. They're attempting to get him to a location where they can have him securely within their custody. But that's part of the argument is that they are still just trying to do that. That's part of the arrest. Getting him to another location. Some of the case law where it discusses that is the State versus Belton and State versus Ondo, which we cited in our briefs. I think those two cases are very similar to this incident, especially Belton and Ondo. We also talked about Shanks, but It kind of goes to the other extreme to say whether it's confinement, and we're on the back end of it. So I focus more on Belton and Ondo, where in Ondo, I believe the defendant was handcuffed. They start to search him, and he bends over and tries to take off. He was in handcuffs, just like Mr. Ajak was in this case, but he wasn't secured, and he attempted to get away. Again, in Belton, it's a similar situation where he's being handcuffed. I believe he was actually removed from the vehicle and handcuffed, but then sat back down and was able to get away when the driver took off. But both of those cases, the person is placed in handcuffs and they're attempting to restrain the person but haven't got them to another secure location or within confinement or custody.
So how long can this non-arrest last, or can an arrest last before? I mean, what if he'd been in there for an hour handcuffed and not allowed to leave and being questioned? He's not arrested after being told he's arrested?
And I don't think there's a bright line rule for it at this point. I do think it's a factual determination for the jury to decide whether he's still under arrest or whether it has gotten to the point of being in custody. I don't think there's a bright line set rule for it.
And that leads to my question. Was this argued to the jury that the arrest had already occurred?
No. That argument wasn't made until it was appealed. Another argument that was made is that he obviously had to be in custody because he wasn't successful in getting away. But like I said before, it's not for lack of trying. The officers, luckily there were several officers there, and they were able to maintain their grip on him. But again, I do not believe he had gotten to the point of being in custody yet at the time he was resisting and pulling away.
Why isn't this a case simply of mischarging, and it should have been changed, or it could be charged again on remand? I mean, should we change the whole definitions of arrest and custody because somebody got charged under the wrong section?
I don't believe he was charged under the wrong section. I believe he was under arrest, and they were continuing to arrest him, getting him from the house out to the vehicle. My belief is that he was still under arrest at that point.
He was still being arrested, because if he's already under arrest, you don't get a, then it switches to
correct.
Custody.
Correct. I think it's an ongoing process.
No question, he was still under arrest, but the question is, did it then switch to custody? Because once you're arrested, then it goes to the custody.
Correct. And I think the arrest is an ongoing process that doesn't turn into custody until they're confined within a physical limitation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And while you have a minute, can you address the second issue about the lack or the existence of manifest injustice with respect to this instructional error?
Yes, sir. Instructional error, I'm not denying that the court included both phrases, obviously. It's there, and we deal with it at this point. But to amount to plain error, I believe that it requires that there be some manifest injustice. And that it affected, the error affected the jury's verdict in some way. There was no discrepancy in this case in any of the testimony about the force that happened, the physical interfering with arrest or the physical resisting
arrest.
Well,
that's the whole point, is it could well, as you know,
yes.
I see by laughing, is his wiggling around could well be seen as not violence and not, but as physical interference with them arresting himself because he's going like this as they're bringing him to the car, but not qualify under the others. And they asked a specific question of what it meant. So doesn't that show the jury was confused by that and considering that particular alternative?
In this case,
yeah, I thought in this case the jury came back and asked about physical resistance.
No, I think that was a different case.
That was one of the ones you were talking about.
Yes,
thank you
yes,
very much. I appreciate that.
In this case, there was no question about it. There was no discrepancy. There was no argument about the differences. It just wasn't mentioned. It wasn't objected by the defense. It wasn't argued in closing. I think I did in one sentence in my closing argument. I read the jury instruction, and so that term was in there because it was part of the jury instruction, but there was no argument on either side about whether it was physical interference versus physical force.
How do you distinguish the Meeks case?
I don't remember the specific facts of the Meeks case, but in this case, there wasn't any other individuals around that he could even be physically interfering with their arrest. There was no argument about, no testimony about that, no argument about it. It was simply him. The other individuals in the residence were in a completely different room.
That's okay.
Back to my initial part of it, I wanted to talk a little bit more about the resisting arrest and the ongoing process of that. One of the arguments was that we had taken several different things and we don't have a specific definition for a term that's used in the statute. So we would want to look at the case law, obviously, any other statutory definitions that we can use to impart some wisdom to us, but also public policy. And mm-hmm. and public policy for resisting arrest is to protect the officers themselves, but also to protect the public and protect the person being arrested so that there's not a lot of violence. And I think that factors into some of this as well, that we take into consideration the public policy in deciding how to define and how to enclose resisting arrest and moving it into custody and then confinement. Thank you.
Counsel, there seems to be a pervasive assumption that an arrest becomes custody and does not ever overlap. So if you are under arrest, you cannot be in custody, and if you are in custody, you cannot be under arrest, that there's no overlap between those two. Is that part of your argument, and if so, why?
I think there's concepts of custody in terms of if a person's not under arrest, but the officer's perhaps asking incriminating guilt-seeking questions such that they could be considered in custody for Miranda purposes.
No, but I'm talking about custody under the statutory definition.
No, I think the statutory definition is unambiguous, and the plain language of the statute, I think it's important to look at the verb tenses here. Knowing that a law enforcement officer is making an arrest for the purpose of preventing him from effecting the arrest resists by violence or physical force. And then the custody, a suspect is held in custody after arrest for any crime. And custody is defined not only by case law, but also by statute in 556.061 subsection 7 of that statute. A person is in custody when the person has been arrested. That's past tense. It ended. The arrest is over. It happened at a finite point in time. Then they are in custody.
So it's your position that there can't be any overlap. A person cannot be guilty of resisting arrest and escape from confinement or escape from custody both.
I would agree with that. I think you're either resisting because you're preventing the effectuation of arrest, or if the jury determines later that it meets the requirements of attempt and escape from custody. There's other, attempting assault on a law enforcement officer because his actions got to the point where someone was injured. Then I think that's a determination made by the jury. But I don't think you could charge both.
Well, that's
my charge them in the alternative.
In the alternative.
But there is a myriad of conduct that's covered by multiple criminal statutes.
Correct.
Why isn't this one of those?
Well, because
has been arrested seems to suggest an ongoing. In fact, by any plain and ordinary meaning of the word arrested, when you're in custody, you are still arrested. You are not going anywhere.
Well, but that is specifically defined under the escape from custody statute. The definition for custody
is after has been arrested.
You're saying, of course, you're still arrested. You're arrested all the way for the rest of your life once you've been arrested. But the question is, are you trying to resist the arrest? And once it's occurred, you're no longer resisting it because it's occurred.
Right.
You're resisting
custody. We're looking at when the violence or physical force is offered. Is it prior to the arrest being effected or not? So, and that's what the statute says. It is making an arrest. And for the purpose, you offer these actions to prevent the effecting of the arrest. And then once the arrest is made, you have been arrested, and then escape from custody comes into play. I would request that this court reverse Mr. Ajak's convictions and discharge him from custody.
Thank you again for a really good argument.
Thank you.